Hello, my name is Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking to maths teacher Craig Latimer. Now, one of my aims of this podcast was, of course, to have all the big names on there. And we've done that, right? We've had Dylan Williams, Tom Sherrington, Daisy Christodoulou. But I also want to give a voice to teachers who perhaps aren't household names, but have amazing things to share. And I think Craig fits into to that camp. Many listeners may not be aware of Craig's work, but I'll tell you what, after this conversation, you will be. One quick one before we start. I've started recording premium versions of my Tips for Teachers online courses. I've done four so far, and I'm dead happy how they've come out. I've done one on habits and routines, one on means of participation, one on checking for understanding, and one on responsive teaching. And the way these online courses work is they're made up of loads of little short videos. I think means of participation has got about 80, like 1 minute videos, 2 minute videos, and so on and so forth, with a really simple idea that you can try the very next day you go into your classroom. Then an opportunity to reflect on what you need to change to make it work, links to any resources, research, videos, and so on and so forth. So if you're interested in those, you can just search Craig Barton online courses, or I'll put a link in the show notes. Please check those out. Anyway, back to the show. Let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Craig Latimer. Spoiler alert, here are Craig's five tips. Tip number one, explicitly teach the skills an expert in your domain uses. Tip two, leave a legacy. Tip three, the principles of cognitive science apply to humans, not just students. Tip four, learning doesn't start in year seven. And tip five, we're going deep here, the secret to a happy life. Woohoo! If you look at the episode description on your podcast player or visit the episode page on tipsforteachers.co.uk, you'll see I've timestamped each of the tips. And also, I've splashed the cash thanks to Patreon sponsors, and there's now a really nice transcript for each episode also on the podcast page, so you can search for keywords and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I'll shut up. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Craig Latimer to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Craig. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you. And for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Yeah. So, maths teacher, trained in the PGCE a long time ago and worked in various schools and now lead maths across Creative Education Trust, which is sort of a national trust of 17 schools.
Fantastic. Right, let's dive straight in. What's tip number one today, please?
So tip number one is explicitly teach the skills an expert in your domain uses. I'm going to try and break that down into things that make sense.
Right, let's go for it.
So AO1 content makes up about 50% or so of the GCSE, but I think takes up a lot of the thinking time and the way that we direct students in lessons. Whereas the other 50%, the reasoning, the problem solving, doesn't get as much, in my opinion, explicit attention within the classroom. I think because people feel like it's less of a tangible thing to sort of harness, therefore it's much harder to teach. I'm going to disagree with that and try and give some tips, mostly math-centered, but try and give some overall tips people could use for their own subjects as well. So I'm gonna ask you a maths question, Craig. So I'm gonna put you on the spot.
Oh no.
So the question is, if 482 pencils cost £115.68, what is the cost of 312 pencils? Now I can see you're writing things down. And the point here is, hopefully you don't know what the numerical answer is.
I can confirm that is true. Yes.
Good. But hopefully you know how to solve the problem. And at the moment, the numbers aren't the important part of that. If I asked you what I asked, how many pencils, how much they cost, or how many I wanted, you couldn't tell me. Yet you could confidently say you can solve the problem. So sort of what's gone on there? Because I think too often in maths classrooms, we go straight into the numbers. What calculations are we doing? Whereas we don't necessarily always need to. So I'm going to read that one more time without the numbers. So if blank pencils cost blank, what is the cost of blank pencils? And introducing that to math teachers, I think, would they would all know how to solve it without the numbers there being important. So my first tip around explicitly teaching the skills an expert in your domain uses is, for maths, one of them is the numbers aren't always that important. And expert mathematicians, I think, will often ignore the numbers, and I would suggest that students often get quite caught up with them. So taking this idea of ignoring the numbers and applying it to a longer question, I think can be a really useful tip for students. I'm thinking about the sort of 4, 5, 6 markers that exist at GCSE, and often students will leave the entire thing blank. So we know from cognitive science you can hold about 6, 7, 8 things in your working memory at any one time. And if you're reading that thing and you're preoccupied with the sort of surface level detail, which would be the numbers in this case, then you might end up being overwhelmed and not able to access anything. So the first tip here would be to ignore the numbers. And we can do one more example for a longer question and see. I've got a visual for this, which I'm not going to share because I know this goes out on a podcast, so we'll see if we can do it, but it might be too much. We'll see what happens. So the question is this, and I'm just going to ignore the numbers first time around. A pyramid has a square base. Each of the 4 sloping edges has length blank. The total length of all 8 edges is blank. Work out the area of the square base. So how was that? One more time?
Yeah, give us it one more. I think I've got it, but yeah, go on, give us it one more time.
So we've got a pyramid with a square base. We've got the length of all the sloping edges. They're all the same. We don't know what they are, but we know they're all the same. Got the total length of all 8 edges. So the 4 sloping and the 4 at the base. The question is, work out the area of the square base. So my sort of conjecture here is that giving that to students, they can do an awful lot of thinking about how to solve this problem, how to get into it, what structures are underpinning there. And that an expert mathematician, first time reading that, even if the numbers were visible, would be ignoring them. And would look at the surface of the question first of all. The original tip was explicitly teach the skills an expert in your domain uses. One of these things I think a mathematician does is ignores the surface level stuff. In this case, often it's the numbers, which sounds counterintuitive for mathematicians, but I think it often is. And you can model that with students, and you can go through this process with them. I would suggest that the way that I've done this before is to show students a question that's sort of 4, 5, 6 marks that you know they're going to struggle with, and discuss cognitive overload, discuss what's going on in their heads, and share with them why they are struggling, and then show them a similar question, but with the numbers missing, and start to break it down for them. Give them a chance as a class, as individuals, or maybe in pairs, to come up with the sort of the furthest plan they can of how to solve the question. They won't be able to come to a numerical answer, but they can start to think, what's step one going to be? What's step two going to be? And then get them all back together again, and as a group, produce a plan. You know, they will come from history lessons and English lessons and MFL lessons, always encouraged for those big, long questions to write a plan before they start producing the big essay. But in maths, you know, our long questions aren't as long, but encouraging a plan, I think, is still a good idea. And by removing the numbers, you're forcing them to do that thinking. So formalise the plan as a group once you've agreed what it should be. I would then reveal the numbers to the students, give them time to then solve the problem, make them feel successful, and then repeat that a few times and slowly scaffold away what you've done. So what you've done is you've hidden the numbers. So at some point you'll have to introduce the numbers, but get them to be thinking in a way that they ignore them first time round, focusing in on what is the surface of this problem before I sort of go deeper into the calculations that I need to do.
Right. Do you want to say anything else, Craig, before I come in here? Because I've got a million things to say here.
I'll pause there. Yeah.
All right. Let's go on this. Right. So, bit of background here. So, this is where I first came across your work. I think this was your first ever tweet, right? Where you tweeted about this. And I read it and I thought, it's one of those things that it's one of the best ideas I've ever seen, because I can't believe this hasn't been done before, or certainly I'm not aware of it. And it's so simple, but so powerful. So I absolutely love it. And that's the kind of main driver why I wanted you to get you on the show. And since you've tweeted out loads of other really good ideas that we're going to dive into. So just a couple of things about this. You often hear that experts and novices think differently. And one of the things that comes out of the research is that experts focus on the deep structure, novices kind of focus on the surface structure. And this seems like a really kind of clear example of that, where students who are struggling latch onto the numbers. And we've all seen this, right? You know, the first two numbers that they see in one of these worded problems, they just either multiply them together, add them together, whatever operation they fancy doing. They just focus in on those numbers without realizing what the problem's about. And this seems like such a smart way to get them to focus on the deep structure by essentially removing the surface features. I really, really like that. I absolutely love it. What I also like, I'll just go on a rant for a bit, then I'll shut up. What I also like about this is, you seem like you've been teaching maybe a similar amount of time to me. Whenever in the early days of kind of thinking about problem solving, it was always, you know, give students like a problem to solve, then a big old sheet of paper, and maybe it's kind of four quadrants, and maybe it's like devise a plan, what do you know, what do you not know? And it never worked. I could never make it work because, and I think now, having thought about this from your perspective here, it's because the numbers are still getting in the way. The problem is still there in its original form, so kids latch onto the numbers. But taking the numbers away, again, means you're forced to think about the deeper structure. So I like this as a real practical way of doing it. Oh, I don't know what order to ask these in. I've got three questions for you. Right, we'll go for this one first. When do you do this? Is this kind of purely kind of building up to revision for an exam? When does it come in kind of a learning episode? You know, when you've introduced an idea, how far a gap before you get them solving problems with that idea in this way? Where does it fit in?
Yeah, that's a question. Yeah, I think John Mason says that if you've any math lesson should involve generalisation. And this is broadly what this is. So that first question that we had with the pencils and the cost is a very typical proportion question. And it works for that. By removing the numbers, you're looking at what is going on in the proportion. So in that sense, it could happen in a Year 7 lesson. That second question was a bigger GCSE question and worth more marks and more of a strategy for tackling those unseen questions where students are going to get in more of a pickle. So I'd say whenever. It's helping them see what the structure is. I've heard Danny Quinn talk before about getting students to respond without numbers. So if you're asking, you know, if there's a shape on the board and he says, well, what's the area? Instead of a kid saying it's 5 times 7, it's the length times the width. Great. But if you remove the numbers in the first place, they haven't got a choice. So it's not a habit you need to build into them. It's the only thing that they can say. So I'd say whenever. Yeah.
Okay, that's right. Okay, let me dig in a bit further on this. Sometimes I like to be awkward and play a bit kind of devil's advocate. And it's not me being nasty, it's just, again, just to try and push it on this. What's the logic with showing them the numbers first? Is there a danger that kind of overwhelms them? How come you don't just show them the no number version first?
To sort of prove to them they're going to struggle. It's that sort of, there's a word for it when you, the hypercorrection effect, is that oh, it? Right. Where, can you solve this question? Or similar to, is it Dan Mayer talks about the migraine and the aspirin?
Yes.
Here's the question with the numbers. Can you solve it? No. Great. I've got a solution to that.
Right.
Because I think showing to students, in my experience of having done this a few times, without the numbers straight away, they just think you're a bit bonkers. Like, we can't solve it, what you're doing. But as if you front load it with, oh, look, we can't solve this. Here's a technique which might help us. Go with me here. It just increases the buy-in.
Yeah, I'm sold on that. I like that. Next one. How does this go down with the kids? What if it goes down badly? In which way does it go down badly, and how do you get the kids back on board?
I'd say you get different camps of people that are more or less stubborn. But at the end of it, you know, when they sit at GCSE, you can't force them to solve it in a certain way. If you know this is in their locker. something that they can rely on. So I often leave it as, if this might not be for everybody, however, if you are trying a question like this and you do get stuck, remember you've got this as a backup. So if people aren't sold the first time around, hopefully, you know, I don't know what they've done in their exams this year, but hopefully they've got it there if they need it. But broadly, there is reluctance at first. They do think you don't know what you're talking about, because the numbers have been the most important thing of, and how can you solve it, and we don't write down plans for these questions, and it feels very much outside of what they've been doing normally. But enough time and with enough carefully chosen questions that they can be successful with it, they broadly come around.
Got it. Final two questions on this, and I'll shut them and let you finish off at any bit of the tip that we've not discussed. Just thinking about exams, if we're thinking practically about students using this in an exam for a question that they're stuck on, is it, because it's quite hard to avoid kind of the numbers once they're there, like is there anything about just, you know, covering them up with your fingers, or, you know, going over them in pencil and rubbing them out? What seems to work to make this work practically?
So I did this on a PowerPoint with them, and then it had a, you know, the sort of the black highlighter function or a black box, and then hid it all and told them they can't do that. Don't scribble them out on their exam. And it's part of that scaffolding process. You know, experts, we do this, that we see the numbers, but we ignore the numbers. And it's just how you scaffold it away. And it's maybe you remove two numbers, then three numbers, or you keep one to two, then you just eventually have all of them. And you get them doing this thought process automatically. They read over the number, and I will do this when I, maybe this is part of scaffolding as well. When all the numbers are revealed, when I read the question, so if we let's go back to the pyramid as a square base question. If the number is up there and they can all see the number, I might read it as each of the four sloping edges has length, I don't care yet.
Nice.
And just to, again, make it a bit explicit of what's going on in my head. So when you can see it, still trying to read it in a way that means you ignore it. I would say I've only, this sort of idea is only about, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months old or so. So I've not fully tested it in every dimension, but I'm looking forward to sort of carrying on with it.
Got it. Right, last question on this. And this is, I don't really know what I'm going to say, so anything could happen here. One thing I'm thinking about a lot at the moment is retrieval and what retrieval practice looks like. And I don't know if you're the same here, but whenever I do either a low stakes quiz or a do now or whatever, my retrieval questions tend to be typically the AO1 questions that you've described at the start. And that seems to make sense, because there are the easier ones to write, the easier ones to assess. You need kids to be able to do that, to be able to do the more complicated things. But of course, the problem with that is what happens is that, well, a couple of things. Kids don't really get a chance to practice the more complex skills aside from when they first initially encounter them. And also the message it kind of gives out about retrieval is this is all you need to remember, just, you know, this kind of surface level of knowledge. So I just wondered if you wanted to reflect on that in your own practice, but then the kind of to tie it back to this tip, would you include this as part of retrieval practice? Have you ever chucked one of these questions in as a do now or a low stakes quiz or a homework or whatever? What's your thoughts on that?
So going back to what you were saying earlier about how problem solving used to be in my head, you know, I'd go on Enrich or I'd look at the UKMT questions and then put them in front of students. But they're so far removed from what is assessed in the curriculum that you can go on, you know, whether you're sort of an exam wizard or exam pro, whatever the bank for your exam board is for resources, and you can filter by AO2 criteria or AO3 criteria. You can pull that bank out there and you can see that the things that make the problem solving unique at GCC are really teachable skills. And it might just be someone's combining two topics together. And that being part of retrieval is absolutely fine. You don't have to... I think I spent the first few years of my career thinking problem solving was this massive, open-ended problems, and students need to be really good at them. But when you pull apart what makes AO2 criteria, AO2, it's really, really teachable. So even getting students to talk about one more thing here, which is about how students write in maths. And that's problem solving. That's reasoning and problem solving when it comes to the curriculum. There's a very particular way that we write answers in maths. I think we say a fact, and then we say, so what? The mean score for Class A is lower than that for Class B. There's your fact. This means that on average, Class B did better. The segment is bisected. This means that the two resulting sides are equal. It's just about disseminating. This takes us neatly to sort of back to the overall tip of explicitly teach the skills an expert in your domain uses. Once you can take what their skill is, you can make it part of retrieval. I couldn't have an enrich problem as part of my retrieval back in the day because my idea of what problem solving meant was different. But by disseminating it down into these discrete skills, ignoring the numbers and solving a number-free problem and making a plan, or writing a sentence in this way that has this structure of fact and so what, are discrete things which you can teach explicitly. And as soon as you can teach it explicitly, you can retrieve it.
So would you just to clarify there, so would you and have you included this as part of a retrieval opportunity? Would it fit into a do now? Or
I would, but I haven't. The nature of my job at the moment is I'm not based in any one school. So I've gone in and delivered this sort of halls full of year 11 and not had the chance to do that constant retrieval afterwards.
Got it.
If I had my own year 11s back again, 100%.
Got it. And was there anything else on this tip that, because I kind of forced you to go on pause whilst I went to my rant there. So was there anything else just, you wanted to add?
I guess just about where it came from was, and this should apply to any teacher of any subject, was that I think it's sort of common when the papers first come out, teachers grab them and try and complete them as quickly as possible. Like, slow down. You are doing so much thinking implicitly in your head because you are an expert. It's really hard to disseminate what those skills are. So this is where this came from. It came from me looking at a question, thinking, what have I done to solve this? Or should I have ignored the numbers? Which sounds like such a simple thing, but the kids aren't doing that.
No.
So what's going on there? So find out tips on how to do it for your subject, I suppose, or to find more tips like this are, when you're doing maths or doing your subject, go really slow. Try and be super aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it. If you've made any jumps in your thinking, pause and think, well, where did that come from? And how can I disseminate it and how can I teach it? And then the other thing would be, I suppose, to upskill yourself, especially when it came to sort of writing, just then that writing framework for maths. You know, our kids do about 5 different subjects every day. When they're being asked to write in 5 different ways, try and find out where you've got those skills that are similar or different to other subjects and make that explicit with your students as well. Would be my way of sort of summing up this, I suppose.
I love it, absolutely love it. There's a danger you've peaked too soon here, Craig, with this one. So that's a tip, but that's brilliant. Right, what is tip number 2, please?
Tip number 2 is leave a legacy. So I'm going to talk about at a department level, but this would apply to anyone with responsibility, a key stage or even whole school. Had a colleague the other day, I don't know if this is a widely known analogy or one that she'd made up or something, but it was about airplanes and sort of going on a flight. She was saying, if every time you went on a flight with a different pilot, maybe from the same airline, there were different routines in place and different qualities of landing and different food, different ways of checking in, you'd be really annoyed and you'd be confused and you'd be livid. And same at the bank, if every cashier was different and if you were seeing a cashier whose first day it was as opposed to whose 10th year it was, you'd want the same service. And companies are really, really good at doing that. You can't really pick out who the first person on their first day is and who's the most experienced person because of all the systems and structures that they've got in place. My argument here is that this should be happening in our schools as well. I think too often we sort of allow our ECTs or our trainees to... We don't excuse what they're doing, but we don't put enough systems and structures in place at a higher level to allow them to shine. So I think schools should adopt this airplane company policy in some senses. And I think what I'm sort of broadly getting at is co-planning, is how it's been discussed. But I don't want to talk about co-planning. I want to take that one step further. I don't think co-planning goes far enough, just producing a set of resources. As a department, you need an aligned pedagogy, you need agreed routines, you need consistent methodologies, you need inbuilt accountability, you need knowledge of where that flexibility arises, so that you have a complete package, almost a brand, which I feel horrible saying. But as a leader of a department or of a school or of a key stage, the more structures you put in place, the more freedom you allow your teachers to have in focusing on what should matter, and you've taken care of the rest. So you should leave a legacy. And I think it's tough as a teacher, because the first time you sort of become a leader is the first time you're responsible for students that you're not in front of.
Yeah.
And no one really prepares you for that. Suddenly you're in charge of students whose names you don't even know. And it's a big leap. But what can you do that means they're getting the best out of you and your experiences and you as a leader? I think a way of thinking about this is, if you left your position and came back in 2 years' time, what evidence would there be that you had worked there? What have you put in place? Because I think as leaders of a school, one, you're entitled to do that, to leave a legacy. I'd argue maybe you're duty-bound to do that as well. You're not a manager where you go around and you cater for the whims of all your staff. You need to be leading them. And by reducing the variability within your department, I think you can really focus on and increase the quality within the department. I look back, I don't know about you. Well, from the title of your book, I think I do know about you. But I look back at me teaching in my first few years, and I'm like in horror. I wish someone had given me clear structures and clear routines. And I can spend my time thinking about, okay, how to implement them well, with a bit of extra space for some creativity and some original thought, but not worrying about what's every single minute of my lesson going to look like, and what routine should I use for this. But it wasn't even a routine. You know, whatever day of the week it was, I'd change whatever I was doing. It just didn't have enough headspace for me to do anything. I'd hate to see myself teach at the beginning of my career now. So I think it's about, as a leader, reduce the variability, but increase the quality. Focus on a few things. When you deliver CPD for your department, if you've said, we do this here, you can pinpoint a few real high leverage ideas to focus on. Staff should be talking about the same things within your department. I think I've worked in a few departments where an idea of what a great lesson was looked so different in each of our heads that we couldn't really talk about it properly. We were just clashing on, your kids are in silence for 10 minutes. What a monster you are. No, your kids were throwing things out. Yeah, but they were free and they were exploring things. There was no consistency around it at all. But a good leader should grab that, I think. I've not heard yet a good reason against doing this. And I would love you to play devil's advocate. The biggest things I've heard are, as an individual teacher, if I'm doing something better, I don't want someone telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And as a leader, it's not your job to be the best at everything, but it's to be the collator of what the best is. So if someone's doing something better, that should be shared and that should be your practice. And if it isn't better, they shouldn't be doing it. Another thing I've heard is if we've got all these things in place, it becomes too easy and people won't engage with it. They'll rock up to their lesson, and they'll just download whatever you've got in place and they'll just sit back and relax. So, well, if they're going to do that, if that's their attitude, with no systems in place, they'll be doing something anyway. They'll be going onto tears the night before, finding the first thing they can and implementing it. At least if you've got structures as a department, you know what to hold them to account for. You know what you should be seeing. So you can say, as a department, we do this here, and you can really start having that conversation about, not catching them out, but pushing them in the right direction, because you've got a real clear vision of what you are expecting. And then other people talk about stifling creativity, I think, when it comes to this as well. And as I mentioned it earlier, I disagree. The more things you put in place, the more structures you put in place, the more routines you put in place, teaching is hard. You've got to think about a lot. The less you have to think about in your lesson, the more time you have to be creative and to be responsive and to have energy and to go home happy at night. I just don't see why, as a leader, we aren't grabbing those things and saying, this is my brand. And that's, it might annoy some people within your department, but I don't think it needs to be the case that every school is for every teacher. Not everyone's going to go work at Michaela and be happy. That's okay. If someone's not fitting into your brand and your culture, and you've done what you can for them, you know, there'll be someone else, and they'll find someone where they're happy, and you'll find someone that's happier with you as well. I'll pause there.
This is great. This, I'm really, really pleased you brought this one up. So I've talked about this many a time in the past, that when I first started teaching, I think looking back, I would have rejected somebody telling me this is how you should structure your lesson and so on. But looking back, I definitely needed it. I 100% definitely, because I was clueless, absolutely, just making stuff up as I went along. And again, taught a load of terrible lessons. And yeah, it took a long, long time for me to start to improve. So I agree with you, but let's just dive into this a little bit more. So you mentioned kind of some set routines, but also kind of room for flexibility. This is a terrible question and one that's very hard to answer, but what would be some of the almost kind of non-negotiables? I know that's a very loaded phrase, but if you're running a department, what are some of the things that you say, no, you know what, we do this way, versus some of the things where you can say, okay, this is where you have a bit of choice to play with. Is it easy to sort those out?
I think to a degree where you can all agree, probably school-wide, of what great looks like, you can. So I'm lucky in my job, I've got a trust lead for science and one for English as well. And you would often think that the three of us would find it hard to agree on what great teaching is, because we've got three very different subjects there. But at a zoomed out level, we can all agree on when the teacher's modelling, as the expert in the room, the kids should be listening. There should be some whole class assessment for learning going on, whether it's mini whiteboards, whether it's multiple choice questions, whether it's whatever. We should all agree that when the kids are working, most of the time it should probably be in silence, because we want them to ingrain it and then to think about it and then not to be distracted. I think there's loads that you can agree on, which has the danger of sounding oppressive and boring and all these things, but we're not here to cater to the whim of the teachers. We're here to give the students the best deal possible, and the evidence is pretty clear on what that is. I'm gutted. The way that I would have most fun in the classroom isn't what I know would be the best for my students. Sometimes I wish I was back in year one and we had these enriched problems and we were spending 60 minutes just having a great time. I was loving it, but it's quite hard to say now that it wasn't the best for them. And if I had some structures in place around what modelling looks like and what practice looks like, and a kid doing one thing once isn't enough, and if one kid in the classroom gives the right answer, you can't take that as proxy for the entire room. I think there's loads of things that you can agree on, and within one department you will then find your own things that you choose to be non-negotiables. You might have a certain way just for ease that you want to set out your do now or your starter. You might want to have a last lesson, last week, last month, last year. It's not essential in every school, but it can be essential for you. I think that's okay. What was the question?
No, you've answered it. Just interested about what you would consider to be kind of non-negotiables versus where. So where would the flexibility come in? What areas of a lesson would you expect teachers to be doing different things?
I think great teaching is responsive teaching. And one that's responding before the lesson starts, because you know you've got these kids and it's this time of day and this is how the last few lessons have gone, and you need to cater it. If you are using co-planned resources, it shouldn't look the same in every single classroom, because they've gone on different journeys and you've got different kids in front of you, and I'd want to see flex there. Within the lesson, where you've got your checks for understanding, again, it shouldn't look the same everywhere. Teachers should be responding to whatever happens. So that's where things would look different. And I think also once all those things are in place, you could have the same lesson with the same pedagogical routines, and you could have three different teachers do it, and their personalities would shine because all their headspace around what they should be thinking about, or, you know, not what they should be thinking about, but around the lesson and the key content is done and ready, and they can be themselves for a little bit. That's a bit of creativity as well, and a bit of freedom to express yourself and be who you are. I think creativity, you know, it's in the name of the trust that I work for, Creative Education Trust, but it's less about it's less about in the moment things being wildly different, and I don't even know what I'm saying now. So what's the question? The question was, where does the flex come in? Where does the creativity come in? And I think also these things can happen from outside of the classroom, where you come up with an idea and then you share it around and you get that structure embedded as well. In terms of within the classroom, I don't think you need to be creative in the moment. I mean, there'll be times when a kid might throw up a misconception and you might find a quick way to deal with it. But again, by having everything else in place gives you that headspace to think about how to deal with that in the moment. I would say that's quite creative. Other people might disagree, I don't know.
I'll tell you what, let me ask you two related questions just on this tip here. So the first is, one thing I see a lot when I visit schools is the classic kind of lethal mutation where, you know, either SLT have decided or head of maths have decided every lesson starts with a do now, or every lesson has, you know, silent modelling or whatever it may be. And you look at these lessons and they are completely different, both in terms of how they look and also their effectiveness. Because one person's, you know, you say a do now, even if you specify it's got to be four questions from something kids have learned in the past, we everybody here knows there's effective ways of doing that and less effective ways of doing that. Do you see this a lot? And is this a danger with the kind of prescribed, that you get these lethal mutations, or, you know, people latch onto a label of something, but it's not interpreted the way it's intended?
100%. And you're teeing up very nicely for tip number three.
Oh, nice.
Which... it's all about how to deliver CPD to ensure that these things don't happen.
We'll leave that's kept listeners on. I like that. Well, let me ask you the final thing on this then. So if we're going down this kind of, for want of a better phrase, this kind of prescribed route where we've got these routines, I assume, well, perhaps I shouldn't assume, who are they coming from? Is it the head, does it typically be the head of department? Is it the head of department and the TLR holders, more experienced teachers within the department? Is it a collaborative thing where it's a, you know, like, let's all decide how our do-nows or whatever look like? Where does it work best?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And that's where being a good leader will come into play around talking and being human and collating these things. And there's a mix there, because I sort of said it earlier, you don't have to be the originator of all the best ideas. You should be open to some flexibility, but also there are some things that you've made your mind up about because you've got that job for a reason, and what you say should go with some things. I used to hate departmental meetings where you get that phony sense of, right, we need a new routine for this. The head of the department's already decided what it's going to be yeah. and tries to guide everybody yeah. to say that and agree that. And what about this, which is on the next slide already, while she's sort of handwriting yeah. things on posters. Let's go with that. And it will change moment by moment, and it will change thing by thing, and there'll be times when you just need to say, we are doing this. But always be open to someone else saying, I think I've got a better idea, or this won't work here, which... it's fine, and you need to do that, but don't waste people's time. You've got that job for a reason. And then there'll be times where you genuinely don't know, or the job is too big. Let's say you want to agree consistent methods for how to solve things in maths. You know, you can delegate that to your team. You might have final say over it, but they can come up with ideas and give it to you, and 90% of them will probably make sense. So that will just come down to a case-by-case basis, but don't be afraid if you have come up with your idea just to say it, because people will be grateful for it. They don't need to be patronized.
Fantastic. All right, Craig, you've teased it already. What's tip number three, please?
Tip number three, I'm going to start with two past experiences of mine, and then I'll say what it is. So once was a this was a long time ago, it wasn't for my current trust, I need to say, was in some CPD around direct instruction, and on the board there, so this is when it was sort of first coming round, or coming around that this school, lots of us hadn't heard of it, was all the good things that direct instruction involves and how you should deliver it in the classroom, and not a single principle was being used by the presenter. You know, you should model things, you should check for understanding. All they were doing was just reading it. Second one, even more obvious, sitting in CPD while someone reads from a slide about how when teaching children, you shouldn't read from a slide because the listening and the reading gets the same part of the brain. So this tip is to please realise that the findings from cognitive science apply to all of us. We use them in classrooms and we use them as great principles for teaching. We share success criteria, we use explicit modelling, we scaffold the process, we give a chance to practice, we receive feedback. It's not because that's how kids learn best, it's because that's how humans learn best. The majority of research on cognitive science, I think I'm right in saying it's probably done with university graduates and people that have got more of an adult brain than they do a sort of a young adolescent brain. So if anything, it should apply even more to us than it should to the students. And then for some reason, it just doesn't happen when people deliver CPD. They might be a great classroom teacher, but they're assuming, maybe it's because they don't want to be patronising, I don't know what it is, but the idea, I think, of novice versus expert, I think blurs people's views here, because teachers will be an expert in loads of things, but they might be an expert marker, an expert subject knowledge. It doesn't mean they're an expert at using a mini whiteboard or cold calling. If your CPD is worth delivering to the people that are in front of you, they won't already be experts. So all the things you would do for novices in your classroom that I mentioned earlier, do them for the adults. Like I said earlier around lethal mutations, you know, this is what will happen. If you don't explicitly model things, if you don't check for understanding, I've got an example here of a framework I used for getting mini whiteboard use, sort of intended across a department. And it isn't tell the teachers to use a mini whiteboard. There's like six different strands to it. All the pre-planning you need to do, all the training you need to do, how are you going to deliver it? What scripts are you going to use? Are you going to model it? Are you going to show them some non-examples of when it doesn't work? The whole thing about mini whiteboards is you need to be responsive. So show them multiple times. If they all get it right, do this. If they all get it wrong, do this. If there's two or three kids that get it right, or get it wrong and the rest get it right, then what do you do? And model it. Model it explicitly. All the great advice that people have heard around what they should do for children, do it for adults. It isn't patronising, and it'll feel weird at first, especially if you want to get people to do sort of Douglimov techniques or things that are active. If you want your staff to practice it, be good at it, they have to model it. They have to do it in front of other adults, and it'll feel weird the first time, but it won't feel weird for long. The best CPD is a bit active and is it, yeah, sounds like all the things that make teaching quite woolly back in the day. Get your kids up and that, but it's about practicing the routine. We do lots of practical things as teachers, so practice it practically. Normalise that behaviour, get people up coaching each other within the CPD. Correct them if they're not doing it right. Tell them how to do it better. And again, the same way that you would use retrieval practice, come back to this CPD. Same way that you would mark their work and give them feedback. Go around and observe lessons. And then what are the biggest misconceptions that you've seen when it's being delivered? Address that. Map out time to not just introduce the idea, but so, you know, the worst case, if they haven't all got it wrong or haven't all got it right, in 3 weeks' time, we need one more CPD booked in. And after that, we might be able to disseminate to heads of department who can then make little tweaks. Plan for all these things. You know, we don't live in a sort of a one and done world of they've seen it once, they can all do it now. And we know that in the classroom. For some reason, we don't know it when we deliver training to adults. So please remember that cognitive science, all these things that make great teaching, make a great CPD as well.
Flipping out, right, okay. I don't think I've ever written so much. Like, it's just getting beyond the joke list now. Right, let's go in with this. So first thing to say is I'm thinking of reissuing my how I wish I taught maths book to be how I wish I delivered CPD, because I'm starting to realise this myself, that, you know, it does seem to be completely different how CPD happens versus what we think about effective lessons. And I'd never realised that before about, you're absolutely right, the fact that a lot of the participants in the Cog Science studies are university students. It's a really smart observation that if it's going to probably apply more to adults than it is to some of our younger learners. I really like that. Second thing to say is, anytime I walk into a seat, like, I hate group work. I've thrown this out there many, many times. sometimes. I'm a real group whiz. And anytime I walk into a CPD session where I see the tables in groups, I just think, oh, nice. Well, this is not. Well, first, I think this is going to be really awkward because I don't particularly want to do this. And then secondly, I think I'm probably going to be able to sit off a little bit here and just let other other members of the group take the lead and so on. I want to pick up that I find this really interesting. So I deliver a lot of CPD myself. Whilst you've been speaking, I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few months anyway, because I've had a few conversations with people like Adam Boxer about this. Why my CPD doesn't mirror more closely what I do in the classroom? And I think you've hit the nail on the head with this patronizing thing. So I do a lot of CPD using diagnostic questions. I'm big into diagnostic questions and so on. Now, the problem I always run into is what I want. I always say to delegates, I say, right, you've got two roles to play here. I want you to play the role of your learners because I need you to experience what this is like as your kids. And then we need to take our learner hat on, put our teacher hat on and think, right, what does this look like in our classroom? And that feels to me, like a sensible approach. The problem is it's quite hard to generate what it's going to feel like to be learners because of this classic curse of knowledge that we have. So if I'm working with a group of maths teachers and I put up, diagnostic question on adding two fractions together, they all know the answer. So when I say, okay, let's vote, they either are all honest and everyone votes for the right answer and then it's hard for me to model how to respond, or they have to to try and help me out of it. Some of them, put C up and then they have to pretend not to know, and it feels inauthentic. And when I was talking to Kieran Mackle, who's a primary colleague, he says that when he does primary CPD, he purposely uses like key stage three content that is a little bit outside of, the regular experience of the primary colleagues, so they feel a bit more like students so that they can better appreciate it. But I think that's a little bit harder for secondary colleagues because if I'm speaking to a mixed audience or something, what am I doing? Whipping up a further maths question or something like that, But so I'll just pause there. Do you see a bit of that? Do you think that's part of the reason why perhaps sometimes CPD isn't quite as effective because we can't make the participants feel like our kids are going to feel?
That's definitely part of it in terms of them seeing the benefits of it. So I've delivered CPD when I was head of the department. I was the only person that was teaching decision maths.
Yeah.
So when I did modelling, I grabbed something from there.
It's good.
Our trust got a big CPD conference recently. Kieran Mackle was there. He spoke to our maths teachers, which was great. But we had Daisy Christodoulou talking about assessment. She did the multiple choice question. What's capital of Moldova? Well, no clue. And it was those things that you can find. It doesn't need to be maths related. It doesn't need to be further maths. If you want to prove how diagnostic questions work, choose something from whatever domain you want. You'd want them to see how you react, how you do something with that knowledge. The maths isn't the important bit. Like earlier, the numbers aren't the important bit. The maths isn't the important bit. It's what you do with that information that matters. I think it is an issue. And it's really hard for teachers to remember what it's like being a student. Really, really hard. I would say go out of the school domain where possible. General knowledge, things like that, where you will alienate some people, but that's sort of what you want sometimes, I think.
Yeah, smart. Makes a lot of sense. Just a few more points on this. The I don't know what point I'm up to now, who knows. But one thing I've been dabbling a lot with is this kind of CPD via stealth. So this is the idea that, mini whiteboards, everybody's chatting on mini whiteboards at the moment. But if you want to do CPD on mini whiteboards, sometimes it's a good idea to do the CPD almost on something else, but use the mini whiteboards to facilitate it. So if you want, if you're doing modelling or something like that, everyone's got a mini whiteboard, and then you can say to people something like, okay, write down the three most difficult things you find when you're modelling yourself. Okay, hold that up so I can see. Oh, amazing. Jane, tell me a bit more about that. Swap with your partner and so on. And then almost at the end of this session, it's almost like a big reveal and say, oh, look, we've been using mini whiteboards. What worked well with that? Do you see any value in that at all, or is that a bit sneaky?
100%. I was, as long as you do that bit at the end, right? As long as you make it explicit, that's the important bit. I've seen people model, try and do that by something, but too stealthy. It's like, at some point, you've got to tell them what you've been doing and why it's been beneficial for you and how you used it in your practice, for sure. I think it depends on your audience and where they're at. It depends on how good they are at using that thing. Do they need all the time focusing just on mini whiteboards? Or if it's, you know, if you've delivered that CPD once and you're revisiting them in 6 months' time, that might be where you do that refresher of that. It's retrieval practice.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to take the forefront because it's retrieval. They know the basics. But if you want them to, you know, because they weren't focusing on the routines you were doing at the time, if you then say at the end, but that was your main focus, it probably won't land as much. But yeah. But if it's retrieval, if it's part of something else, then I think 100%.
Interesting. Right, final 2 points on this. I could chat to you all day about this. One is just an observation from me. So I'm obsessed with Atomic Habits, the book by James Clear. I don't know if you've read it. It's sold like 20 million copies or something like that. So I'm not exactly new to the party with this. But he cites a really interesting study that I've used a lot with CPD. And that is this, it's called an implementation statement or an implementation action or something like that. And it's the idea that, let's say the study was about like diets and exercise and stuff. If you say, you know, you get all this motivational material and you think, right, okay, I'm definitely going to go to the gym. I'm going to go next week. It never happens. Whereas if you say, I'm going to go Wednesday, 10 o'clock, like the jump up in participation, it's something like, you know, 40% increase or something like that. I wonder whether this is true in CPD, that, you know, you leave CPD with all these good intentions and life gets in the way. Whereas if you state the exact time you are going to do something for the first time, it's more likely to happen. What's your thoughts on that?
100%. So a few things you can do within your CPD is give people, well, one, if they've, we'll stick with mini whiteboards because I love mini whiteboards. One, if they've practiced it within your lesson or within your CPD, it's less of a strain on them to then do it in the classroom because they've practiced it. Also, at the end of that CPD, get them to grab their laptops or whatever. Right, we've got 10 minutes left over now. Mm-hmm. Look at a lesson that's coming up. Find the class you're worrying about the least other stuff with.
Yeah, that's good.
And a lesson that will work best for it. And now produce a set of questions or start to produce it. Hopefully, you know, they can finish it. But if they at least get started, they know that time. And then you say, you know, tell your colleagues, send an email to your HOD. They're going to come. If they can catch you at that time doing it, great. If not, you know, alas, and probably missed over, but 100% get them to commit to, give them some time to start to work on it within that CPD. Like you say, otherwise they're going to walk out the door and then, oh, I'm teaching this tomorrow and I'm doing that and I'm photocopying and life will get in the way. So yes, get them to commit it and get them to tell someone else.
Yeah.
If that person ends up coming to the classroom or not, I bet it, like you say, it's going to increase the success rate of them delivering it. 100%, do that, yes.
Absolutely. One final thing on this, Craig. I think this is where a lot of CPD falls down, is it doesn't have the follow-up. It tends to be one-off things. Now, I experience this myself when I'm called in as like an external speaker or whatever. It's always a bit frustrating for me because I can leave the sessions thinking, okay, that seemed to go well. People seem to enjoy it and so on, but I have no idea what happens unless I can come back again 3 months later or whatever. I have no idea. But when you deliver CPD within your own school or a group of schools you've got a relationship with, it's much easier to do the follow-up. But what I've never thought to do, and it's such a simple idea that which you've said there, is this idea of, you know, observing where possible, colleagues doing it, but then spotting misconceptions just as you would do, you know, within a lesson. And then the follow-up session almost starts as if you've marked a load of homework with, okay, here's some examples of really good things I've seen. Here's some examples of something that's almost good, but if I describe it to you, can you see what could have made it a bit better? All that stuff that would be so normal and natural to do in lesson doesn't happen enough, does it, with CPD, either for kind of practical reasons or just because people don't realise it's a smart thing to do.
Yeah, the danger of the amount of, you know, people to try and buy someone in to do a thing, which is fine, you know, if you want to come into work at any of our schools, you can. But we're going to make sure that once you're gone, if you're not coming back in, we build something to chase up on it again. The danger is that, yeah, again, that sort of one and done, oh, Craig Barton came in, why can't you all use mini whiteboards now? Why can't you all use diagnostic questions properly now? It's like, well, because people learned it once. Same as I say to it, it's the exact same. Oh, I taught these kids Pythagoras a month ago. Now they can't do it. Of course they can't do it anymore. It's in there, and you just need to retrieve it, and you need to tweak it, and you need to do all these all these things that make great teaching. Just, yeah, apply it to CPD. Whether it's the original speaker you get that came in, or whether it's someone in-house then grabs that board and sort of keeps it rolling. Maybe something worth doing. You know, speak to them. Great question for them. Like, how are you going to follow this up? And obviously, it's not on you at all to you know, it's on them, but just might encourage it lasting a bit longer.
Brilliant. All right, Craig, what is tip number four, please?
Well, number four is, this is a bit of a shorter one, learning doesn't start in year seven. So hopefully people's minds are blown. So if you think about all the misconceptions that you could name that a student may have acquired by the end of year seven, since sort of walking in September the 2nd or whatever it is, there's going to be loads. But then you pause and realise, well, they're in year seven. Well, seven, that means there's been at least 6 years before that where they've accrued as many misconceptions, as many mistakes. They've forgotten as much stuff as they could in that 1 year, times by six. And the danger then is that we don't realise that. And you get to year 11 and you meet hardworking students that have good attendance, that still don't know the times tables, that still count on their fingers, like I'm doing now, that still, when adding lists of numbers, don't jump to the number bonds first that make their life easier. Don't really know what a fraction represents. And I suggest that they've been taught too high. It's so easy to grab, when you teach year seven, your long-term plan or scheme of work or whatever it is and go, right, this is where our course starts. This is where learning starts for these students. I've not seen them before, sort of out of sight, out of mind. This must be where we begin. But there's just so much that they could have mislearnt, forgotten before you, that you have to go beyond or backwards from year seven and start looking at primary. I'm going to highlight this point with an example that I first heard Vicky Priddle talk about, that I spoke about with our head teachers a few months ago, and that Kieran Mackle spoke to our HODs about, which is counting. Like, if you ask, I'm probably going to say anyone, but certainly secondary school math teachers, what does it take to count? Well, you do one, then two, then three, then four, then five, and that's how you count. But there's five components to counting. This blew my mind. So there being a stable order, in fact, it has to go one, two, three, four. You can't go one, four, five. That's one thing, fine. One-to-one correspondence. In fact, you can count objects. So one object, two objects, three. The object isn't the number three, but it can be the third one. And now the next three, I think, is where it gets a bit more interesting. So cardinality, the idea that by the time you've counted the third object, not only are you at position three, there are three objects in total now. So three is one place on a number line, but it has a size to it. And to me, that links to jumping from counting your fingers to jumping in one go. If you think of three as one, two, three, or 17 as one, two, three, four, five, up 17, you're always going to count on your fingers, either forwards or backwards. If you haven't understood cardinality, you're not going to know you can make those jumps. So where we see these gaps in year 11 still, I think it's because we haven't addressed the gaps from primary. The next one, order irrelevance. If I give you seven objects and say, Craig, how many objects can you see here? Well, you'll count seven objects. And if I were to rearrange them and say, how many are there now? You would hopefully say seven. Some people would have to count them again.
Yeah.
Well, that links to commutativity. If they haven't got that concept, and we never teach this explicitly, cardinality, order, irrelevance, the fifth one is abstraction. The idea that sort of anything can be counted. And also one thing can be multiple numbers at the same time. So if I have a group of five objects, well, it can be one group, or it can be five things at the same time. If I think about a fraction 3/7, is that three of something, or is it less than one of something? Well, it's both at the same time. And that idea of abstraction, again, so this is just counting. There's going to be a whole wealth of these things at Key Stage 1 and Key Stage 2 that lead up to things at Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4. And if we aren't teaching at the periphery of what students already know, they're not going to learn anything. So this is why you get students in year 11 that can't do their times tables or add efficiently, because they spent their whole time learning from year 7 upwards. And really, you'd been better off going a few years back. So I think ways to address this are get your Key Stage 2 experts to come in and speak to secondary leaders. Get the Vicky Priddles and Kieran Mackles of the world, or just, you know, your feeder school. They'll know loads more. Attend the sessions. Read the books. The things like MathsConf will say sort of the key stage it's aimed at, which I think is wrong. It's the key stage that the maths is. It's not the key stage that of who it's aimed at. You know, I would learn as much from a key stage 2 session as I would from any other session, because I'm teaching after that key stage. So the maths is key stage 2, but it's relevant to me because my kids would have gone through that journey already. We've got a school next year, really excited about this, that's hiring a key stage 2 specialist for the secondary school to do this intervention. You know, see if that's a possibility, or see if you can do some job sharing or some swaps or, you know, something like that. And the other thing I want to say, the amount of time and effort that goes into year 11 intervention. You know, the issue here is that students have been taught at the wrong point for 4 years. You go, oh God, their grades aren't very good. Quick, let's blitz them for a year and see what happens. Well, if you flip that and did the intervention at year 7, then you're going to spend the next 4 years, 8, 9, 10, 11, building on actual solid ground because you fixed all those issues from beforehand. So you shouldn't need to rethink at year 11. So, yeah, it's a fault in my teaching still that I don't know enough to go into a primary school and talk about their maths. Secondary, no problem. But what, you know, the amount of stuff I don't know scares me sometimes, because someone could talk about counting for half an hour and I can have my drawer on the floor. It just doesn't, that shouldn't quite be right. I'm convinced the more we know about it at secondary, the better our students' outcomes will be. So yes, learning does not start at year 7.
This is another biggie here. You know, when you sent these tips through, I thought this tip was going to be the exact opposite of what you've described, which I find fascinating here. So Joe Morgan did a piece of like a video on YouTube that's completely freely available. I'll link to it, which was aimed at secondary teachers, showing them all the things that kids know in year 6. Well, sorry, all the things kids have experienced in year 6. And it's frightening, right? Like, you see some of the depth of math and you're like, whoa, okay. You know, that's essentially our year 7 scheme of work, as, you know, 80% of it has been covered at year 6. So what I thought you were going to say, and as I said, I found this fascinating, was be aware what kids have done at year 6. So make sure the work at year 7 is more challenging. So, you know, have a look at your year 7 scheme of work. Don't bother spending ages on place value because they've done it for, you know, the last 3 or 4 years. Let's crack on with a bit of algebra and so on and so forth. But my interpretation is it's almost kind of the opposite. It's make sure that understanding really kind of is secure. And I guess my kind of follow-up to that is how? Does it mean our kind of checks for understanding need to be better? And if so, you know, what do they need to look like? Is it a case of not assuming just because they've covered things for 3 or 4 years that they know it? And my fear with that is the year 7 scheme of work essentially becomes the year 6 scheme of work. And then we know kids get a bit kind of bored and switched off because they're doing the same maths that they've done in primary. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, 100%. And this won't apply to all the students, but, you know, that video from Joe that says all the wonderful things that they have done, great. It just means there's going to be some kids that have got so many misconceptions about so many things. Yeah. Within the classroom, things probably don't need to change. I'm probably talking about the bottom, attainment-wise, 5 to 10% of your students. Mm. But the fact that a kid can go through 5 years of secondary school, there are some factors outside of your control, illness and attendance and things like that, fine. But where you've got a student that's got good attendance and a good attitude and is in your sort of low set year 11 and can't do basic maths, something's gone wrong. And I would just shift intervention. Whatever time and effort and energy goes into year 11, put it into year 7 and fix it then. It doesn't need to rearrange your whole schemes of work, because largely students will be successful. This isn't about every year 7 student, it's just about being aware. And we're so aware of misconceptions at secondary. We know what kids have learned. We know they haven't mastered it, and we look out for them. And we make sure we go back just the right level before teaching expanding double brackets. We know all the little things to look out for around multiplying for negatives and the coefficients and are they going to square the powers and all that. But we don't know when it comes to adding or multiplying and things like that. So we just need to upskill ourselves a little bit by going back further and invest the time in those students. Not everyone. Don't rewrite the entire year 7 scheme of work. But put something in place to work on those students. Otherwise, they're going to spend 5 years not doing anything. They're trying their hardest, and you know, it's just not pitched at the right level. And you know, the same way that yes, they might have learnt it. Trigonometry is on the Key Stage 3 curriculum now. Doesn't mean when I start teaching Year 10, I'm going to assume they all know how to do it. So just invest time in yourselves, in your department, in learning about what happens at Key Stage 2. This probably applies for any subject as well. And then spend time in Year 7 identifying those students. And if you're going to put on a masterclass for Year 11 students, do it for Year 7 instead and give them 4 years of better learning, rather than waiting till the very end. You go, oh, they still can't do it. Yeah, well, no wonder.
Right, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask you an awkward question now, right? So we know that there's a bit of a recruitment crisis in maths. We know that the majority of departments probably, you'd be lucky if you've got math specialists teaching all the classes. Maybe you've got teachers from other subjects doing a little bit of math teaching here and there. Maybe you've got a lot of part-time teachers with split classes and so on and so forth. What invariably happens is that your strongest teachers tend to put on Year 11 classes because, again, there's this push for exam success and so on and so forth. And that seems to trickle down that the Year 7 almost becomes a bit of a kind of hodgepodge where you've got, you know, split classes left, right and centre, the PE teacher, the geography teacher's teaching a bit of this and so on. But it's very hard to break that cycle, because if you invert it for 1 year, maybe your GCSE results go down and then there's all kind of pressure and so on. So working within the constraints that we know we have, how would you allocate staff? Would it be strong on Year 11, strong on Year 7, and then kind of Year 9, just kind of that's where the trouble comes? What, you know, being realistic, how do we do, how do we solve this?
So linking back to tip number 2, around leaving a legacy and having structures in place. As long as you've got a solid person looking after each year group, you only need 5 in that sense, then whatever routines and structures and things are in place are then embedded. And if you've got a PE teacher, because of your legacy, because of your brand, and because of all those things, you're mitigating as much as possible for all those things. But you are touching on another really important point, which is, like, ethically, what's the right thing to do? Let's say you had, so the grades now are numbered, right? Nine to one. Let's say you had 1,000 grades to give out to 200 pupils. I made the numbers all for myself. But would it be ethical to give everyone to attempt to work in a way that gives everyone a 6, where you ignore the people that are doing better than that, and you put all your time and energy into those on 1s and 2s and 3s and 4s and 5s? Or are you aiming for a normal distribution? Or are you saying that if you're on an 8, I don't really care about you anymore, because 8 and 9, you'll have the same life chances broadly, and I want to get my 3s to a 4? Or are you saying that if we don't get these kids 9s, they can't get into Oxford, and they can't become the next Einstein, and they can't do this? Because we've got limited resources, and you have to decide. Which is tricky, schools are estate schools. Parents don't choose. They don't choose the ethos that they send their students to. You have to do that for them. And I've worked in schools where the priority is 4+. Yeah. 4+, 7+, that's sort of it. And then if someone's on a 5, you just sort of ignore them, because 7+ is your A-level grade, mm-hmm. and 4+ is your sort of large life chances grade. And you have to decide where you want to divert your energy and your best teachers and your resources. And I don't know what the perfect answer is to that, but the current system we have in place, you know, when you have intervention, sort of aimed at that 4+ and then aimed at that top set, probably most of the time. I don't know, is that right? You got kids that are on a grade 1, you sort of say, well, don't worry about them, they're not going to get a 4 anyway. Well, it should be trying to get them a 2. I don't know. You have to decide ethically, philosophically, for yourself, either as a head teacher or as a head of department, where and how you want to allocate these resources. And if you have a bump in GCSE results 1 year, but you know that in 2 years' time, everyone's going to increase, do you do it? Because, you know, it's one of the toughest decisions I think you need to make is where do you put your resources? I think that's a very long way of me not answering your question.
No, it's good. It's a tricky one. All right, Craig, 5th and final tip, please.
Fifth and final tip, I sent this over as the secret to a happy life.
I saw this and I thought, right, I'm going to pay attention here. This is going to be the game changer. Go for it.
Yeah. So this isn't going to be pedagogical. And this isn't aimed at anyone with sort of serious mental health problems and the intention not to demean or undermine anyone going through that. But it's sort of the rest of us spend our life fluctuating between feeling invincible and on the top of the world and then being a bit grumpy. Sometimes and teaching can be so rewarding, but it can be lonely and it can be stressful and it can be really pressured as well. I was at a conference, one of the sort of summer conferences, a few years ago, and every speaker was pretty dull, and they had one person booked for a double over lunch. I was like, oh great, 2 hours of dullness instead. And it was the most incredible 2 hours of my life. It was a man called Andy Cope, Dr. Andy Cope, who is the UK's self-professed doctor of happiness. And he wrote his thesis on, is it possible to be happier without anything within your life changing? And it was great. And he gave five tips. I won't give them all because I'm running out of time and I don't want to take his job off him. But a few tips he gave that just resonated. Number one was, when you get home or when you wake up in the morning, be the best you for 5 minutes. So you've probably had a horrible day, or sometimes you've had a horrible day, and the temptation is, as soon as you get in, this is your place where you've got your partner or your children or your cat, and you unwind and you let loose. Don't. Like, take a pause before you knock on the door or put your key in the door and just think, right, for 5 minutes I'm going to be positive. I'm going to ask what other people are doing. I'm going to bask in their happiness from their day and what they've achieved. And it's important to have people to offload to, but not when you walk in. You don't want this sort of Pavlovian reaction of, oh, the door's going right, another moan's about to happen. So it's sometimes about other people's happiness as well. But if you do that for 5 minutes, you're making a certain effort to be happy. It might also just change your mood a little bit when you go on in the rest of the day. So that was one tip. Another one was, stop wishing your life away. I think teachers are awful for this. If you're in your 30s, you've got about 2,500 weeks or so to go. So imagine starting a half term on a Monday and going, whew, 6 weeks to go. So you're wishing for a shorter life. Like, don't say 6 weeks to go. Like, find the joy in a Monday morning, in a Wednesday, in a Friday period five. Stop saying, I wish it was Friday already, or 2 days to go, or it's hump day today. Like, teachers are the worst. As soon as a half term starts, this is a short one. What are you talking about? Like, this is your life. It's finite. Enjoy it. Find the little things. And with that, he's then spoke about hygge. I don't know if you've come across hygge. So hygge is this Danish idea of comfort and coziness. And they sort of embed it in their furniture and their ways of life. And it's one of the reasons that the Danes and the Norwegians has always come off as the happiest people on the planet. And you're speaking about seasonal hygge. So in the summer, what would your hygge be? What would bring you comfort and coziness? And it would be like reading a book under a shady tree. This is personalised to each person. In the autumn, it might be having a tomato soup and a polystyrene cup or watching some fireworks. For me, in the winter, this is an awful one, but in London, it would be on a cold evening, wrapping up warm, getting a box of popcorn chicken from KFC and walking along the canal at night. And it was just a little time to give me a bit of headspace and enjoy myself. I started thinking about what school hygge would be. I started writing a list last night of the little things you can just appreciate in the day that have to happen anyway, but where can you find the joy in it? Sort of seek out the moments and just appreciate them. It's like a pristine, newly cleaned whiteboard and writing on that for the first time. Ah, that's beautiful. A tidy classroom at the end of the day. Oh, God. Meeting a class for the first time. What a joy. Writing with a chisel tip pen. For me, chisel tip all the way. That's quite satisfying. Doing a mini whiteboard routine and everyone gets it right. Like savour these moments. They're going to happen anyway, but don't rush past them. Seeing that kid that's annoyed you all year, this is quite a personal one, smash out a performance on the piano in front of the whole school at the end of term. That was just beautiful. Finishing a new seating plan, that's a big one. And marking the last question of the last paper in the pile, there's no better feeling than that. And these are things that are going to happen anyway, but just pause and appreciate them a little bit. Find the joy in a Friday period five. Find the joy in a Wednesday and in a Monday morning. And yeah, read Hygge by Mike Viking. It's a great little book.
Wow, what a fantastic tip that is to end on, Craig. Just a very brief reflection from me on this. Absolutely fantastic. I spoke to Jamie Tom on the podcast a number of episodes ago, and he's very much into slow teaching and mindset and so on. And one of his tips was turn down the negativity radio. And he says that teaching's really bad for this, that we're full of these negative thoughts. You teach four good lessons, you have one ropey one. What's the only one you reflect on? It's the bad lesson and so on. And he talked about things he does with like his little boy. I think his little boy's 3 or 4. And at the end of each day, they say what their favourite part of the day was and so on. These things are so important in any job, but particularly teaching, where you've got to be performing all the time and so on. So that was just one reflection. But the second one, the not wishing your life away, I think is a huge one. It was one of the reasons I took a break from full-time classroom teaching, because I was doing this. Everybody on their timetable has one or two lessons that they do not look forward to. I had a particularly year 10 class. I would have them Thursday period 6 every week, last lesson of the day, and I would dread it. And I would dread it from, I'd be happy at the end of Thursday period 6, but even Friday mid-afternoon, I'd start thinking, in 4 days' time, I'm going to be, and it would hang over me all weekend, and it was hard. And you always have something like this. There's always something in the week that you dread, and if you're anything like me, it doesn't matter if you've got something to look forward to, it's the dread that kind of overshadows this. And also related to that, is because the teaching year is divided up into 6 half terms, you're never that far away from a holiday, so you're always like, it's always a countdown, 5 more sleeps and all this kind of stuff. And the years just tick away. They just tick away. And, you know, before you know it, you're old, you're cynical, and, you know, and all these moments have kind of gone. So this is a big thing that I'm reflecting on, and I'm really pleased you've mentioned this. And there's some lovely ideas. I'm terrible. This is the last thing I say. I promise I shouldn't be here. But I'm terrible for that. As soon as I walk through the door, the moaning comes out. But I'm going to do that now, be my best me for 5 minutes. I think that, in fact, I'm going to try this, because what I could do is, listeners won't know this because I've cutted it out, but Alexa just went through, my wife interrupting a podcast. That's a cardinal sin in this house. So I could go down and be dead grumpy, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to be my best me for 5 minutes and see where that gets us. Craig, that's absolutely brilliant. Right, let me hand over to you then. Well, because I was going to talk about this. Tell us what listeners should check out. But as I say, are you new to Twitter permanently, or was this just kind of new guys that you popped up in? And where can listeners kind of get more of your stuff? Because it's brilliant.
Yeah, it sort of links to tip number 5 as well, I suppose. I've been on Twitter under my name for years. Originally just personal, and then sort of tried to turn it into professional about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, and putting some things out there. But I became so aware that anytime I sent something out, if within 5 minutes I hadn't got 100 likes, I became really self-conscious, and I was just like, I was checking it over and over again, and oh god, people think I'm stupid, and my colleagues, my peers are going to see this. I need to delete it. I deleted half the things, and it was destroying. You know, if I tried to, it came from a nice, I was trying to be helpful, but if I tried to do it and then left the house, it'd be on my mind, and it's like, this isn't healthy. So there is an account under my name, but I don't really use it as much anymore. So I made this new account thinking, right, if I'm anonymous, maybe I won't worry. So I still, you know, I feel like I've been in this game long enough to give some things back, and I'd like to do that because I've learned so much from other people through the same medium. So I thought, well, let's make an anonymous one. So check out Teaching Solutions on Twitter. But it just really helped. And this might quite ruin my anonymity a little bit, but it was like being, you know, trolls sort of harass you anonymously. I was trying to become an anti-troll, anonymously help people. And it made me just feel so much better. So this account's been going on for about 2 months or so, and been overwhelmed. I think that the freedom it gave me to express things, you know, it's bypassed the engagement the other account had by a mile. So it was just quite interesting. So check that out. But also, I don't know, be an anonymous troll sometimes if you want, and help people out. So that's where you can hear more from me on that Twitter account. And then do you want other things?
Yeah, go on, yeah, of course.
In terms of, you've been doing this for a long time, and there's loads of things. I don't want to repeat anything that people have already said. So one is just about, go out there and listen to people and read people that are diametrically opposed to what you believe. Like I've had the fortune of, I wrote a master's based around Joe Bowler's work. I've trained under Anne Watson. I've worked at the school that Bruno Reddy and Chris Bolton were at and had both their jobs. I visited Michaela. I visited Helen Hindle's school where they were doing inquiry learning. All those things, people that, you know, they're so different in their backgrounds, but I learned something from every one of those things. So just try and broaden what you're listening to and what you're reading. And then two actual things. One book, which I've not heard mentioned, is called Inclusive Mathematics. It's by Anne Watson and Mike Ollerton. And it's quite old now, but if anyone reads that and doesn't get something from it, I mean, well done. And then there's a CPD event called the Institute of Mathematical Pedagogy, which happens once a year. It's happening in a few days' time. It starts on my birthday. I can't wait. And it's sort of 3 or 4 days in a convent in rural Oxfordshire, and it's the most incredible CPD. For anyone that's sort of done the maths comps a few times and starts to hear the same things, go to this because it will blow your mind. It's quite limited in spaces, and I hope no one takes mine for next year. But yeah, it's incredible. And I think that's me, Tom.
Wow. Brilliant. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. I know I say this a lot, but I've learned so much here. I mean, again, I make a load of notes, but I put stars next to things that I really need to focus on, and it's like some kind of big constellation on my page here. So this has been absolutely brilliant. So Craig, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Cheers. Thank you.